This is Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. In the next half hour, we'll have a report from the International Women's Solidarity Conference held in Havana. Over 3,000 women from 81 countries gathered in the Cuban capital for several days of workshops addressing the struggles of working women throughout the world. We'll talk to two participants in the conference about some of the issues discussed at the three-day meeting. Then we'll hear the continuation of my interview with Marguerite Feitlowitz, author of the book A Lexicon of Terror, Argentina and the Legacies of Torture. The book examines how language was used and continues to be used in Argentina to mask the horrors of the Dirty War. Coming up next on Our Americas. This year's Summit of the Americas in Santiago de Chile, the annual meeting of heads of state from throughout the hemisphere, spawned a counter-summit that was meant to challenge the predominant neoliberal worldview of the governing elite of the hemisphere. While the Summit of the Americas is designed to discuss regional trade issues, cooperation on the drug war, and other development concerns, the counter-summit was an attempt to put issues affecting working people on the top of the agenda. Next week, we'll have a full analysis of the developments from the Summit of the Americas. For now, we'll take a look at another major international meeting. In Cuba, the only country left out of the official festivities in Santiago, a different kind of gathering took place just days before the Summit of the Americas. Over 3,000 women from more than 81 countries gathered in Havana for the International Women's Solidarity Conference. Producer Maria Victoria Maldonado is in Havana, and she prepared this summary for Our Americas of the three-day conference.
Over 3,000 women from 81 countries gathered on April 16 to close the three-day International Women's Solidarity Conference sponsored by the Federation of Cuban Women. The presentations included performances by young Cuban musicians and singer Celia Gonzalez, remarks by Maria Cecilia Cornejo of the International Democratic Federation of Women, and the reading of the final conclusions by Eunice Santana, President of the World Council of Churches. The highlight of the evening was a 4.5-hour speech by Cuban's President Fidel Castro Ruz, who was received with unanimous ovation. After being presented as the utmost defender of the rights of women, Fidel opened his speech saying, quote, "I cannot accept such honorable qualifier. I rather consider myself a fighter for the rights of all human beings. And to be able to consider myself as such, I had to struggle against myself." And then he went on to talk about the devastating conditions faced by women all over the world and all the issues that were brought up by the women at the conference. The conference took place in different parts of the city. On April 13, the first day, was dedicated to the discussion of the topics brought up by the women, organized around 6 commissions and 14 roundtables. Issues such as participation of women in political arena, sustainable development, health, education, culture, media, violence, discrimination, independence, sovereignty, and peace were some of the themes. There were also 14 roundtable discussions, which included a variety of topics ranging from rural, indigenous, and black women to women in science, the environment, art, religion, the rights of women, reproductive rights, elder women, young women, women in parliament, and women in unions. There were extra gatherings during the night with discussions of issues such as socialist and Marxist women, gender and power, and migrant and displaced women. Wednesday the 15th was dedicated to the National Solidarity for Cuba, with the conference focusing on the economic blockade and the consequences of the biological warfare against Cuban products, livestock, and people. Latin American delegations were amazingly big, with delegations from Brazil with over 500 women, from Argentina with over 400 women, Colombia over 300 women, Mexico over 250 women.
Producer Maria Victoria Maldonado is in Havana, and she participated in the International Women's Solidarity Conference. Joining us now on the line is actress Viney Burrows, who is a UN representative for the International Democratic Federation of Women. She, of course, was one of the 3,000-plus women who attended the conference. Viney, what's your sense of the conference? How do you feel now that it's over?
I'm fine. Excited because this has been such a glorious experience to see 3,000 women literally from around the world in 6 61 countries in support of the Cuban Revolution and support of the Cuban people, you know, the women especially. Mm-hmm. You know, the theme of the conference, and when you come into the Karl Marx Theater, where most of the plenaries, the two plenary sessions were held, you see this great big sign. It's the International Encounter of Solidarity Among Women, Equality, Development, and Peace. That's particularly interesting to me as the representative at the United Nations for the Women's International Democratic Federation, that the conference has focused on the goals of the first United Nations decade for women, equality, development, and peace, and that without peace, we cannot have equality, we cannot have development. The buzzword here is neoliberal, liberalism, and Castro defined it as developed capitalism, which is a very interesting, you know, a very interesting analysis. That is the maturing of capitalism, really, before it falls, because what it does to women, to students, to farmers, to peasants around the world, what it does in terms of unemployment, what it is doing to the financial institutions. Castro gave a brilliant analysis of the regional economic integration of Europe, for example, and he had hoped, as Simon Bolivar had hoped, and Marti had hoped, that the Americas would be joined regionally. He says now with NAFTA, Canada, Mexico, and the United States are bound together in a really an economic vice where the United States is holding all of the power. 80% of Mexico's trade is with the United States. And those of us in the states who oppose NAFTA, who point to the maquiladoras, for example, and what that has done to working people, and particularly working women.
Viney Burroughs is, of course, a world-renowned actress, and she's also the United Nations representative for the International Democratic Federation of Women, one of the 3,000 women who participated in the international conference, Women's Solidarity Conference in Havana. Joining us now, also, who's down there in Havana, is Marilyn Clement, who is the executive director of the U.S. section of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, one of the organizations who spearheaded the large U.S. delegation down to the conference. Marilyn, your impressions about the conference that you just attended?
Well, it's just been fabulous to be with women from all of these countries, and they have been very surprised that we had such a large delegation, that there were 300 women from the United States and Canada, and that, you know, they the people from, particularly from Latin America, were worried about us. They said, you know, are you going to be okay? We know that your government tries to keep you from traveling to Cuba, and you know, you or some of you may have traveled without documents. How are you going to get back in? Are you going to be put in jail? Are you going to be facing trial? And they were thrilled to see that so many people from the United States are in solidarity, both with them, with the women of the world in the various issues that they're facing under globalization, but also with Cuba. So that was good. And we met in six commissions, and I was chairing the Commission on Independence, Sovereignty, and Peace. And one of the things that came out of that, I mean, there were many, many resolutions, but the Japanese women put forward the resolution of abolition of nuclear weapons, total abolition of nuclear weapons, abolition of the military blocks, all of the military blocks, to end those military blocks worldwide, and to end the U.S. weapons of mass destruction, particularly to look at those and the blockade, all of the economic blockades in the world and how they're used as weapons against people. So the U.S. Joined with that resolution, as did the Mediterranean women. There was the Association of Mediterranean Women, and they talked about, you know, 4,500 children and elderly people dying in Iraq every month under this blockade, and then the fact that in the Mediterranean area $28 billion a year is now spent on military weapons, and that is more than even is spent on education. So that was one of the things that came out there. There were about five delegations from Colombia, from different sectors within Colombia, and they talked about the atrocious conditions that they're under. I mean, there's tremendous warfare going on in Colombia, and they talked about we have to be very conscious of that. It's hidden from the world what's going on there.
Marilyn Clement, how about, let me ask you this, in terms of, we've seen a lot of major conferences with women over the last several years, of course the perhaps highest profile one being the Beijing summit that took place a few years ago. How is this a continuation of that work, and from here, where do you go from here in terms of implementing some of the resolutions and some of the actions taken in this conference in Havana?
Well, we talked in the report from the Discrimination and Violence Against Women group, for example, they followed up on Beijing by talking about CEDAW and how important it is to pass CEDAW, which is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. The United States is not a signatory to it, and it's one of the campaigns that we must develop, is that campaign to pass that, to get the United States to sign on to it. They talked about the concerns around the discrimination and violence against women and how violence has such a high personal and social cost, the violence against women, including the economic cost that women cannot work, they're disabled, low mental and physical health, they become tobacco and alcohol abusers and drug abusers, and that, you know, CEDAW stands to help correct all of those things.
Yeah, why don't you just tell us briefly about some of the other work, some of the other commissions that were coordinated as part of the conference?
Okay, well, there was one on women, economy, and sustainable development. And coming out of that, they insisted that we must measure the non-paid value of women's work in the home, that must be measured, and we must get to the point where we pay for the work of women, the unpaid work of women, training and strengthening the network of women's organizations, the international network of women. We're talking about really coming out of here with an international network of women that will meet again within 5 years, and that we, you know, we'll be working together. One of the things we did was to call for an international day of solidarity with the women of Cuba on March 8th next year and on succeeding years until we get to the point where the blockade is gone and we can be together.
We were speaking with Marilyn Clement, who is the executive director of the U.S. chapter of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. We were also on the line with actress Viney Burroughs and producer Maria Victoria Maldonado, all three of whom participated in the International Women's Solidarity Conference held in Havana. You're listening to Our Americas, the weekly report on Latin America and the Caribbean. I'm Mario Murillo. Last week, we presented a feature on the leader and the founder of the Argentine human rights group, the Mothers of La Plaza de Mayo. As we mentioned in our previous program, March 24th marked the 22nd anniversary of what has been called the Gentleman's Coup in Argentina, bringing to power one of the hemisphere's most brutal military dictatorships. From 1976 to 1983, when Argentina embarked on the slow and difficult transition to democracy, over 30,000 people were tortured, killed, or disappeared in a neo-fascist campaign designed to clean up society of its so-called subversive elements. The horrors of the Argentine Dirty War is the subject of a new book published by Oxford University Press. A Lexicon of Terror, Argentina and the Legacies of Torture, explores the way language was used by the Argentine generals during the dictatorship in order to mask the harsh realities of the Dirty War. It also looks at how this language continues to play a part in the culture of denial and acceptance that divides Argentine society up to today. Literary translator, essayist, and author Marguerite Feitlewitz wrote the book A Lexicon of Terror. Here are some more excerpts of our interview.
The coup was called the Process for National Reorganization. They were extremely careful to be clinical in their language at this point. They were very careful to avoid any use of words like revolution, which had characterized any number of governments of any number of stripes. And their basic position at the very beginning was, even as they dissolved the Congress, even as they dissolved the Parliament, even as they outlawed labor unions, even as they took over all of the monies from the General Confederation of Labor, basically brought to a complete halt all democratic expressions and organizations, they said they were going to reorganize the country so that democracy would one day be able to be practiced in Argentina, but rationally, not emotionally, as it had been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they were saying that civilians had failed at governing themselves. There's historical evidence for that, as we know.
Right. And the language that was used was always to make it look as if they were benevolent, as if they were being asked to take on this role of reorganization.
Absolutely. Not only were they benevolent, were they forgiving of a citizenry that had been wayward, they were making a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very big theme, that the generals themselves were making the sacrifice to step into the breach, to heal this disaster that had been brought on by civilian institutions, by civilian government, and that as they were making a sacrifice, the citizenry had to come to terms with its own guilt. These are all ways of getting complicity, of getting the citizenry to be obedient and fearful, and to basically turn off their own minds so as to listen to the greater mind of the junta, if you will.
I just want to remind the listeners that we're speaking with Marguerite Feitlowitz, who is the author of A Lexicon of Terror, Argentina and the Legacies of Torture, published by Oxford University Press. And of course, the benevolence was obviously hidden expressed in the tactics that were used during that period, the torture, the disappearances, and the language even in that was incredible. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that. Talk about some of those tactics, the operation centers. Maybe we can get
Absolutely.
Into some of that.
Even as they were peacefully acceding to power and taking great pains to present themselves as gentlemen, even Jorge Luis Borges said, "At last we are governed by gentlemen." Even as they were presenting themselves in this very kind of refined and cultured way, they were kidnapping about 150 people a day in the first month of the dictatorship. The basic mode of operations was kidnap, transferred to a clandestine torture center, of which there were some 340 all over the country, in military installations, in police precincts, in factories, including a Ford factory, in some private properties, in hospitals, in former radio stations.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was reading recently a report that even in Ford, in the Ford factory, that there was in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, it was used as a torture
camp.
One of the camps. It has many roots. I mean, obviously, partially in the United States, counterinsurgency tactics that were instilled upon many of the Argentine generals and officers. But also, it goes even beyond that to some of the other, I guess you can say, darkest sectors of modern history, specifically some of the fascist elements in Germany and whatnot. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because that's something that seems to be at times overlooked.
Absolutely. I think what happened in this situation is you had a confluence of international, primarily financial, but also political interests coming together with a long entrenched history in Argentina of historically weak civilian institutions, very weak judiciary, very weak legislative, a long history of turning to the military to kind of shore up civilian disasters. As you know, there's a saying in Argentina, everyone wants his own colonel. There's another saying, a darker saying, which is necesitamos una mano dura, which is we need a strong hand to rule us. So these strains in Argentina, that sense of helplessness and kind of black-humored, ironic shame run through political life in Argentina. I argue very strongly in this book that the Dirty War is itself a legacy of torture in Argentina. The picana, the electric prod, which was first invented in 1930, has been since then standard issue at most police precincts all over the country. There have been in the 1930s, in the 1940s, in the 1950s, huge scandals erupting in the Senate over just this issue of torture. And I've read those transcripts, and it's shocking. It's really chilling. The testimonies read almost, I mean, they're almost interchangeable with the testimonies I was taking in the 1980s that go back to what people lived in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So this issue of torture is one that has exploded periodically in Argentina. As you say, there was outside support, and that goes back to the early 1960s with the Doctrine for National Security. Part of the Cold War was, of course, the East-West axis, but there was also a North-South axis, and under Robert McNamara, there was a very large, sophisticated program put in place to train elite Latin American military officers who, as he said, saw things our way. And they were trained at places like the School of the Americas. As you said, they were trained in counterinsurgency, which was, of course, a euphemism. Mm-hmm. They were trained in...
Well, for them, counterinsurgency was not just combating armed combatants, guerrillas, but also combating, as it was referred to, the water, from keeping the water away from the fish, the guerrillas being the fish, and the water being any support or any even semblance of connection with the guerrillas, whether it's a civilian population or whether it's a labor sector or the student movement or whatever, and that was followed to the T in Argentina.
Absolutely. The program included surveillance tactics of individuals and groups, particularly labor unions, particularly universities, particularly the media. Journalists were targeted. There were all kinds of methods for group surveillance, group control, but also psychological and physical pressure of individuals. And they were trained specifically in physical torture, psychological torture, extortion, blackmail. Mm-hmm. I've read those manuals, and they actually play out a scenario where you would arrest a student, for example, and then bring in his or her parents.
Mm-hmm. Now, A Lexicon of Terror, the main focus, the book, A Lexicon of Terror, Argentina and the Legacies of Torture, obviously just by the name, it refers to the language and the words and how some of this has been adopted even up until today. It's sort of almost like an acceptance of this very brutal period. Why did you choose to focus on this? I guess as a linguist and somebody who, an essayist and poet, but in terms of how it's impacted Argentina, maybe you can tell us about that.
Sure. I'd actually like to go back and say one thing about the School of the Americas, mm-hmm. if I could. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people who were tortured by men who were trained at the School of the Americas, and they all said the same thing, which is that these men were exquisitely specialized in their respective tasks. If it was physical torture, if it was psychic torture, if it was kidnapping, if it was group surveillance, they were very, very specialized. They did one thing and one thing only. In fact, to have been trained at the School of the Americas became so prestigious that a lot of really lower-ranking men bragged that they'd been sent there, even when they hadn't. 57,000 men from all over Latin America were trained at the School of the Americas. Those men, in turn, went back to their countries and trained others. So a lot of people I've spoken with said, well, yeah, they would definitely, they would periodically leave the camps to return to Buenos Aires or to go to Paraguay or to go to Bolivia or to go to Chile to run training sessions. Mm-hmm. So there was that 57,000 figure is really much, much larger.
Mm-hmm. And it continues today. I mean, maybe not so much in Argentina, but in other countries. I mean, in Colombia, for example, a country that has 10,000 graduates from the School of the Americas, those same tactics are happening today and escalating much more so. But in any event, let's get into the issue,
yes,
of the language.
Absolutely.
A Lexicon of Terror, as the title connotes, it talks about language and how it's been adopted. It was adopted by the generals and by the military in Argentina, but it's also been kind of accepted almost as part of the everyday form of speaking in Argentina, mm-hmm. as you document in the book. Talk about that.
Okay. I became fascinated with the whole issue of language as I was translating Griselda's work, which is extremely encoded. And clearly this is a way of escaping censorship. It's a time-honored way for writers to escape censorship. During the trial of the ex-commanders, while I was working on a lot of these plays by Griselda, there was an explosion of this language. In Argentina, survivors day after day were testifying from April to December 1985, and the only way they could discuss what happened to them in the camps was to use this very specialized language. So you had a process of survivors translating as they went, and all of a sudden there was this new vocabulary. Words like, very common words like trasladar, for example, which normally means to move something from one place to another. In the camps it meant transfer, and that what people knew was that there were roundups, generally periodically on Wednesday afternoons. Numbers were called, prisoners were moved out, never to be seen again. In most camps, people had no idea what exactly was happening to these people. There were reports circulating, we know it's true now, that most of those people were drugged, stripped, and dropped from Navy airplanes into the sea. We also know now that a whole generation of elite Navy officers participated in these death flights. Thousands of men, the most elite of the Navy. So that's a word that has now one meaning. People don't use trasladar for any other meaning. It is a word that, as many survivors have told me, carries more pain and terror than any other word.
Mm-hmm. The term desaparecido.
Desaparecido.
Mm-hmm.
That is the quintessential term. As the general said, some people were destined to be absent forever, and they thought that the population was going to accept this. As we know, the population did not accept this. But I was very interested in finding out how these words were lived. I really believe that we can't understand what happened in Argentina, either within or without the camps, unless we understand how those words were lived.
Literary translator and essayist Marguerite Feitlowitz is the author of A Lexicon of Terror, Argentina and the Legacies of Torture, published by the Oxford University Press.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio dos luceros que cuando los abro perfecto distingo lo negro del blanco y en el alto cielo su fondo estrellado y en las multitudes el hombre que yo amo.
And that's about all the time we have on today's program. How Americas is produced at the studios of WBAI Pacifica Radio in cooperation with NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America. It is funded in part by grants from the Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media, the Funding Exchange, and the New York State Council on the Arts. Associate producers are Sarah Gill, Amy Standen, Walter Krakmal, and Laura Tarantini, with production assistance by Vicky Hippel and Miguel Gonzalez. Thanks to Steve Dudley and Jeremy Scahill, and of course Maria Victoria Maldonado. If you have any questions or comments, you can write to us at Our Americas, P.O. Box 1091, New York, New York, 10116. For Our Americas, I'm Mario Murillo. Thanks for listening, and stay strong.
Me ha dado el sonido y el abecedario con las palabras que pienso y declaro, madre, amigo, hermano y luz alumbrando la ruta del alma del que estoy amando. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado la marcha de mis pies cansados, con ellos anduve ciudades y charcos, playas y desiertos, montañas y llanos, y la casa tuya, tu calle y tu patio.